Lost. KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
When you see how the 1% has been running away from the rest of us, with its share of national income continuing to go up and social distance mounting and mounting, we know that some people do benefit, even though most of us would gain from inclusion and investment in all of us. And so we need movements like the Fight for 15, the Fight for Immigrant Rights, the Fight to House the Unhoused, to make sure that we can actually change things. So we really need to shift our mindset and begin to realize when we work out of a spirit of mutuality, we begin to generate a more prosperous economy.
In this episode, we hear from Manuel Pastor on how shocks to the system are precipitating a great awakening and growing movements to transform the economy to our economy. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Building the Solidarity Economy, Awakening to Our Mutuality and Shifting the Terrain of Power. When engineers prototype a machine, they run it at high speed and high stress to see what blows out. The aim is to determine where the flaws and weaknesses are and hopefully to correct them. These days, it seems like everything is broken. Maybe we need an entirely new and different design. At the core of this civilizational breakdown is an extractive economy that wastes both nature and people, and at the same time, is hoovering extreme wealth up to the billionaire class. But with breakdown comes breakthrough. Professor Manuel Pastor believes we're living through a moment of profound transformation. It will come down to what we do or don't do at this moment of radical change. One thing is for sure. This time, it's apocalyptic in the original meaning of the word, which is a revelation or an unveiling. Manuel Pastor spoke at a virtual Bioneers conference.
It's been a very difficult last couple of years. We have been and are still experiencing the COVID pandemic. And it's important to realize that this was a shock to our system. COVID was the disease that revealed our illnesses as a society. The racial wealth gap, which meant that communities of color were not able to survive the blows of an uneven economy, inadequate health care. Black people died at 1.4 times the rate of white folks. And if we look in Los Angeles County and age adjust for that, we'll see that the black death rates were twice those of white folks, the Latino death rates three times. So COVID was the disease that revealed our illnesses of economic precarity, of systematic racial disparities, of inadequate health care. However, it also revealed our mutuality. The number of people who stepped up in mutual aid societies, the food kitchens that stepped forward, communities beginning to care for the unhoused amongst them. And of course, people wearing masks, even if not to just protect themselves, but to protect their neighbors. And we, in fact, need to think about COVID as occurring as part of three big hits to the consciousness. COVID itself revealing disparity, the murder of George Floyd and the reckoning around structural racism in the United States, and of course, all of that coming on top of 4 years of a presidential administration that seemed to have cruelty as its main strategy, that wound up cooking in xenophobia, racism, and hate, and a thought to polarize the society. So where does that leave us now?
As Manuel Pastor points out, one central pivot of transformation that's being revealed is to change our societal pronoun from me to we. Manuel Pastor is a distinguished professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at the University of California. He's director of its Equity Research Institute. He's long been one of the most astute researchers studying the economic, environmental, and social inequities facing low-income urban communities. He's also worked tirelessly to address these systemic crises through movement building. But, he says, the upside of the downside is that the concatenation of crises that bedevil us has shaken loose the foundational ideological assumptions about what an economy is for and who gets to benefit.
I would argue there is no going back to what we had before. People often use the word recovery, but why would we want to go back to a normal that did not work for so many, with so many crowded into jobs that were high risk and low pay, with so many left without a social safety net, with so many subject to racist policing, racist education, and even racist environmental conditions in terms of climate inequities? Rather than using the term recovery, we need to understand that this is a moment of transformation, and it's going to require reimagination and restructuring to be able to get forward to a model that both recognizes the disparities that have existed, challenges inequality, and begins to lift up our commonalities. Traditional economics, often called neoclassical or neoliberal economics, assumes that people are selfish, they act just in their self-interest, and that markets exist to coordinate that to bless. And actually, sometimes on the left, people think folks act in their self-interest and you need the state to constrain people. But the fascinating thing is that people also act out of mutuality, out of concern. You know, when there's a disaster like COVID, there are price gougers, but there's also people who rush to the rescue of other folks. And the question is, does our system feed the wolf of selfishness, or does it feed the spirit of inclusion and fairness and mutuality? And that's a really important thing that I think is wrong, both with the way we theorize and with the way we structure.
The prevailing ideology of modern capitalist economics arose in the mid-19th century in tandem with the Industrial Revolution and the Olympian rise of the plutocratic robber barons and their bloated monopolistic trusts. During that Gilded Age, a leading anti-monopoly crusader named Henry Demarest Lloyd described the ideological conflict around the plutocrats' so-called survival of the fittest social Darwinist ideology in this way. Quote, "The golden rule of business is, there is no hope for any of us, but the weakest must go first. There is no other field of human associations in which any such rule of action is allowed. The man who should apply in his family or in his citizenship this survival of the fittest theory, as it is professed and operated in business, would be a monster and would speedily be made extinct. To divide the supply of food between himself and his children according to their relative powers of calculation would be a short road to the penitentiary or the gallows. In trade, men have not yet risen to the family life of animals. It is a race to the bad, and the winners are the worst." End quote. In fact, what Charles Darwin was referring to with survival of the fittest was an ecological paradigm of the survival of those best fitted to their environment, place, and time. Around the same time, the Russian naturalist and philosopher Peter Kropotkin reported on his studies of animal behavior in his famous book, Mutual Aid. He concluded this, quote, "Happily enough, competition is not the rule either in the animal world or in mankind. It is limited among animals to exceptional periods. Better conditions are created by the elimination of competition, by means of mutual aid and mutual support. That is the tendency of nature." End quote. In fact, Kropotkin proved to be correct. It's cooperation and symbiosis that make the world go round. The classical survival of the fittest economic model is less an ideology than a theology, an article of blind faith in the supremacy of the market to solve problems and in the benevolence of billionaires. Surveying the state of the world, it's self-evident that the invisible hand of the market has failed catastrophically.
And we know in our heart that when businesses treat people correctly, that those businesses thrive. We know that if low wages and the ability to destroy the environment were the driving factors behind economic growth, Haiti would be the richest country on earth. But it's not. Neoliberalism has hijacked common sense. So, you know, people, when they look at their individual situation, they individualize it, like somehow it's my fault rather than a result of the structures of inequalities, or that markets will take care of it, or that a tax cut on the rich will generate prosperity. There's no evidence of that over the last 45 years that we've been trying it. It's never generated economic growth. What's generated economic growth is public investment in each other. That's what generated the long period of economic prosperity between 1945 and 1970. So we really need to shift our mindset and begin to realize when we work out of a spirit of mutuality, we begin to generate a more prosperous economy.
Indeed, as the late Senator Gaylord Nelson, principal founder of Earth Day, said, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. Real wealth creation is based on replenishing natural systems and restoring the built environment, especially our infrastructure and cities. It's based on investing in our communities and workforce. It's been shown to work best when done all at once. Restoration could become an estimated $100 trillion market. There's plenty of work to do, plenty of people to do it, an abundant financial incentive. When we return, more from Manuel Pastor on how to bring mutuality into the economy and why movements matter. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. This is Building the Solidarity Economy, Awakening to Our Mutuality, and Shifting the Terrain of Power. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most. And learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. In his book, Solidarity Economics, Why Mutuality and Movements Matter, which he co-wrote with Chris Jenner, Manuel Pastor lays out the kinds of mind shifts and practical applications that can rewrite the rules at this transformative moment. It starts with reframing the term, the economy.
When we talk about the economy, it makes it seem like it's a set of natural laws, things given by God, the market, that's outside of us. But it's our economy. These are the rules we make about whether to compete or to collaborate. It's a tax system that either lets Amazon go off scot-free with no taxes or ensures that they pay taxes and treat their workers decently. we should always go back to talking about our economy, the set of rules we set up and use to either protect property or to protect people. Second big point is that we need to recognize that mutuality actually drives our economy and stress how mutuality, fairness, and inclusion can generate prosperity for the many. Now, this is a really key point because even progressives sometimes seem like they accept the arguments of conservatives that inclusion might be a good thing morally, but somehow it's going to come at the cost of economic prosperity. But you know that when you have a society that's underinvesting in young people, you're not going to have more productivity in the future. You know, when you've got a system of over-policing and over-incarcerating, that you're wasting talent that could contribute. You know, when you are not legalizing people who've been in this country, perhaps without papers, but for quite a long period of time, you're not only disenfranchising them politically, you're disenfranchising them economically, and you're wasting their talents and ability to contribute. And research is showing that those metropolitan areas that are more equal, less residentially segregated, and less fragmented actually tend to grow more sustainably over time.
Those same metropolitan areas that are more equitable also experience less pollution and environmental degradation. Manuel Pastor cites compelling statistics that reflect how vital it is to build a solidarity economy. In Los Angeles County, while the median income for white households hovers around $86,000 a year, Latino households plunge to $52,000, and black households to $45,000. It gets even worse. For households with children under the age of 5, the income median for white households is about $124,000 a year. For black and Latino households, it's about $51,000. Pastor says that means we're baking racial inequality into the future, unless we act to change the terms of engagement.
First, we need to center the struggle for racial equity and against racism. We need all of us to have a deep interrogation of how anti-black and anti-indigenous racism has set the terrain for othering, for xenophobia, for hate, for structural inequality that in fact affects all of us. Even immigrants who come to this country, the terrain of inequality is set by those fundamental dynamics of the taking of land and the taking of labor to amass capital to make this country. So if we really want to make a world that is better, need to center the struggle for racial equity and take it upon ourselves to understand the deep role of anti-black racism.
But the ground truth of the COVID pandemic is that it radically amplified the social Darwinism corrupting the economy. The richest Americans raked in the biggest upward transfer of wealth in the country's history. Concierge Service from the U.S. Treasury Department provided them with no-interest cash to capitalize on a fire sale of vulnerable small and medium-sized businesses, while also supporting lucrative stock buybacks and executive bonuses. While the super-rich got filthy richer, struggling taxpayers received a pittance in direct assistance, and a temporary one at that. Meanwhile, companies started complaining bitterly that workers weren't showing up. Rather than go back to crappy low-wage jobs that already were often not enough to live on, so-called essential workers additionally now faced mortal danger from the pandemic. It's a nightmare scenario amounting to your money or your life. Thousands of workers staged union and wildcat strikes across the country.
People are sick and tired of being sick and tired, as Fannie Lou Hamer said. They're sick and tired of being taken advantage of. They're sick and tired of the top 5% getting all the wealth, and those of us on the bottom, you know, are struggling to make ends meet, living from paycheck to paycheck.
It's about sticking together as a team to win. Yeah. These men and women who are standing in line today are really fighting for the new hires and the people of the future.
We still deserve human rights and human decency, and I would say that enough pay to pay your rent and get a car to work if you need to and put groceries in your fridge is a human right.
You know, the business press is calling it the Great Resignation, because from the point of view of employers, it's people leaving and not wanting to come to work. But I think it'd be better to call it the Great Rebellion or the Great Awakening. What's going on is that workers are saying, you know what? We've just been through this huge existential crisis where we realized what work was essential. And it was not being the manager of a hedge fund. It was being a grocery store clerk or an agricultural worker or a healthcare worker. And yet so many of those jobs are not treated with the pay, respect, accommodation that they deserve. And what I think you're seeing is that workers are fed up. I mean, restaurant employers used to expect that people would come in for low wages, uncertain hours, and disrespected work. And now people are saying, really? And I have to risk death from COVID too? Later, I'm not coming in. So you're really seeing a kind of recalibration of what work means in people's lives and a demand for more from it. But I also think that it's important to realize that, you know, this comes now, it's about a dozen or so years since the 2008-2009 financial crisis, in which capitalism ran itself into the ground and expected the taxpayers to bail them out of the mistakes they made, even as they left Black and Latino homeowners, particularly in the wind, losing all of their assets, with the racial wealth gap worsening over time. Young people entered into the labor market in that period of time. Then they saw Trump get elected and mismanage this last crisis. People don't trust this system. They know that something is wrong. They know that they deserve better. And even though they don't quite yet have the collective means for articulating their concerns, they're articulating them individually by deciding not to go to work or quitting the jobs they have or getting together with other people to demand improvements in the conditions at work.
Manuel Pastor has a practical vision for how to begin to restructure our economy. It grew out of prior work he and Chris Jenner had done, including an economic report called From Resistance to Renewal, a 12-step program for the California economy. They helped develop a dynamic suite of transformative policies to build the solidarity economy movement. It's grounded in green infrastructure, education, workforce development, housing, transportation systems, and the care economy for the 21st century.
And that is a movement that looks at co-ops, community land trusts, mutual aid societies, everything where people come together to forge institutions, economic institutions that center collective well-being and provide an alternative to the capitalist orientation of most of our institutions. So you can imagine making sure that financial institutions lend to communities so that they can start community land trusts. You can imagine making it easier for worker co-ops to form and also making it easier for them to get the capital finance that they need to be able to move forward. You can see, as happened during the pandemic, government delivering aid often through these mutual aid societies or community-based organizations in ways that build up that sector of the economy. That's going to take some time, and we don't have a lot of time. We need to scale up quickly. So the solidarity economy vision is kind of a post-capitalist vision. We also think there's a lot you can do with currently existing businesses. How do we reward the businesses that are paying taxes, paying decent wages, training their workers, providing paid family leave, and penalize those businesses that are not doing that? How do we take that large part of our economy that exists right now and shift it in the direction of serving mutuality?
When the pandemic paralyzed the U.S. economy, community mutual aid networks sprang up or leapt into overdrive around the country. They tried to ensure people living alone received the help they needed, such as groceries or rides to the doctor. It's been civil society, not the invisible hand of the market, that has risen to the occasion to grow and strengthen these networks and incorporate them into official structures where that's been possible. But there have to be some fundamental changes in our economy and our government policies to make a difference that really makes a difference in people's lives for the long haul. Which is why movements matter, says Manuel Pastor.
That means we need to commit to social movements. There's a famous quote from Martin Luther King. He actually borrowed it from someone else, which is that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Let me add, pioneers, but it requires that someone bend it. It doesn't get to justice just on its own. That's going to require you. It's going to require you working with others. It's going to require broad social movements that challenge the constellation of political power, that challenge economic and racial privilege, and insist on mutuality as the guiding principle for our economy and solidarity economics as our framework for getting forward. When you see how the 1% has been running away from the rest of us, with its share of national income continuing to go up and social distance mounting and mounting, we know that some people do benefit, even though most of us would gain from inclusion and investment in all of us. And so we need movements like the Fight for 15, the Fight for Immigrant Rights, the Fight to House the Unhoused, to make sure that we can actually change things. We also know that the other side effect of movements is just as markets make us selfish. They teach us to be self-interested, look out for ourselves instead of someone else, and see the world as zero sum. Just as markets make us selfish, movements make us mutual. They build the habits of solidarity, intersectionality, and mutual consideration that are key to make our economy function for all of us. Solidarity economics insists that we should address the climate crisis, not just because there's a cost-benefit analysis of how that would be good for us in the long run, but simply that we need to move past an extractive relationship with the planet and understand that we must stand in solidarity with the planet, with other species, and with future generations to make sure we have a planet that lasts.
Manuel Pastor. Building the solidarity economy, awakening to our mutuality and shifting the terrain of power. Executive producer Kenny Ausubel. Written by Kenny Ausubel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Production assistants, Monica Lopez. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 250.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
It was January 2009, and I had just landed in Sydney after traveling solo for a few months through India, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand. It was the small hours when I checked in at my hostel, and the receptionist informed me that I had a message to call home as soon as possible. The news was not good. Dad was on his deathbed in Sligo General, and they were giving him a day or two to live. My airline put me on the next available flight home, but it wouldn't depart for another 30 hours. I lay on my dormitory bunk bed, staring at the flaking ceiling, and listening to my sleeping roommates fart and snore like the wind section in some dystopian orchestra, before I decided to get up and go on an existential sightseeing tour of Sydney, night walking my way through lonely places. As morning broke, I headed to a favoured port of call in any city I visit, the local botanic gardens. Sydney's gardens are as different to their older Dublin sister as the kangaroo paw plant is to the hawthorn, but just as soothing to an addled mind. There I noticed a flyer for a Gate Theatre production of Brian Friel's Faith Healer. It was playing as part of the Sydney Festival to mark the playwright's 80th birthday. A sign, surely. Dad was 5 months off his own 80th birthday. I rang the box office. It was sold out. I explained my situation, and I was in. Faith Healer is a play that explores the elusive nature of truth, memory, and hope through the varying perspectives of its three lead characters. I had seen it once before in On Grain On Theatre, Letterkenny, but that evening in Sydney, I lived it. I measured each utterance in each character's monologue against the life of my father, the life he gave me, and the life we shared. I knew that just like the eponymous Faith Healer Frank, his long-suffering partner Grace, and their manager Teddy, we might remember things differently. But I prayed that Dad was holding on to chance, and not, like Frank, renouncing it as the final curtain threatened to fall. Outside, the moon shone gently and a healing had settled on me. So what would Dad do now? I asked myself. He'd go rambling and get whiskey drunk. And in no particular order either. So off I set with just that intention. I saw that the famous Spiegel tent had a residency in Hyde Park as part of the festival, so I headed that direction and found a queue of hundreds snaking from it like a lizard's tail. The large vintage cinema sign outside said sold out, and a man kept walking along the line, warning that anyone without a ticket wouldn't get in. Each time more people would leave, but I had nowhere else to go. The queue got smaller. I got talking to a Spanish girl behind me, Magui, another solo traveller. Three women then skipped the queue in front of us. On any other night, there would have been friction. But within minutes, we were chatting. The trio were Naomi, a French native, a Kiwi, Manuka, and an Aussie called Wendy. They didn't have tickets either, but we sensed one of those rare nights unfurling before us as the tent continued to lure us closer. By the time we reached it, on the stroke of the witching hour, we just walked in. The music, courtesy of a local band called The Bakery, was a raucous blend of funk, soul, ska and reggae, all driven by a serious wind and brass section. We danced and we danced until my t-shirt became a second skin, and in that place of pure abandon, I seemed to transcend any distance between myself and my father. A man who once told me that when he first got a car with a radio, he regularly had to pull over to the side of the road for a good dance, especially if a decent tune came on. Eventually, the band ignored our roars for one more encore, and we spilled into the beautiful still night, spent yet renewed. Following the kind of goodbyes usually reserved for old friends, I headed for my hostel, picked up my backpack and passport, and as dawn was breaking, began the long journey to Sligo General Hospital. If you're ever heading that way yourself, I wouldn't recommend starting in Sydney. On flights from Sydney to Auckland, Auckland to LA, LA to Amsterdam, and Amsterdam to Dublin, I whispered secrets about life and loss to complete strangers who, emboldened by my candid disclosures, shared theirs with me, safe in the knowledge they would go no further. I dared not call home when I finally landed in Dublin, where a lift was waiting to bring me to Sligo. But by the time I walked into his ward, Dad was sitting up, holding court, and would do so for another 3 glorious years. I guess Frank Hardy had one more miracle left in him, after all.
Someday, when I'm off lonely low. When the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look.
The first time I heard somebody on a book festival panel refer to James Joyce as Jim, I winced at the overfamiliarity. I discovered later that Joyce was in fact known to close friends and family as Jim, and winced again, this time at my own presumption. Writers know the importance of a name. Joyce didn't choose Ulysses by accident. Vladimir Nabokov, a great fan of Joyce, spends the first paragraph of his novel, Lolita, making plays on his heroine's name. You immediately see how fixated the narrator is. Call me Ishmael is the intriguing opening sentence to Herman Melville's Moby Dick, and because he puts it like that, you can't be sure that this is the narrator's name, or is there something more subtle going on? And in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, Gollum's descent into despair is epitomized by his telling Frodo that we even forgot our own name. Names can change, and sometimes the change is a story in itself. I discovered recently that a man I've known by one name for the past 8 years has had another name all along. Because of a medical condition, I need professional carers to help me get in and out of bed. They also visit some afternoons to help me with stretches and exercise. One of the carers who comes to me is Anthony from Nigeria. He has strong views on African politics and is particularly interested in comparing the colonial experience of Nigeria with that of Ireland. He has written a book primarily aimed at debunking some of the more extravagant claims peddled in Africa by self-styled religious pastors. I said I'd love to read it, and he brought me a copy on his next visit. That's when I noticed a different name on the cover, Imokpa. Anthony explained that when he went to Catholic school in Nigeria, aged 10, the teachers had difficulty pronouncing Imokpa and decided he needed a Christian name, so they called him Anthony. He's been in Ireland for over 20 years and has been going by Anthony all that time. Since he told me this, I've taken to calling him by his Nigerian name. When my wife first addressed him as Imokpa, he acknowledged it quite formally and said, "Thank you." In the 8 years that I've required assistance, as well as the Irish care team, I've had carers from Nepal, India, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, Spain, Belgium, Romania, Portugal, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Congo, Cameroon, Malawi, Nigeria, Liberia, Mexico, and Brazil. To make life a bit more interesting while we work, we play music or a podcast. Sometimes it's my choice, other times it's the carers, so we might pick a radio station from Lagos or Harare or Rio de Janeiro. At some point last year, I started listening to the wonderful RTE Radio Drama on One recording of Ulysses from 1982. It's 26 hours long, so you can listen to it in snatches of 40 minutes or so while doing some stretches or clocking up miles on an exercise bike. One week, while working with Anthony / Imokpa, I played some particularly impenetrable bits of Ulysses at our afternoon sessions. We found ourselves mired in episode 3, where Stephen walks on Sandymount Strand thinking deep, barely intelligible thoughts, the Beecher's Brook of Ulysses that unseats many would-be Joyceans. When Friday came around, I asked Imokpa what he would like to listen to. His response was immediate and adamant. Anything but that stuff you had on all week. Another carer, Ola, also from Nigeria, has renamed Ulysses The Leg of the Duck. We were listening to episode 15, the one in Nighttown, where our heroes visit the city's brothels, and Sissy Caffrey sings, "I gave it to Molly because she was jolly, the leg of the duck, the leg of the duck." Ola came back to me after a few days and said he couldn't get the chant out of his head all weekend. He'd found himself humming and singing it constantly. He said even his children had picked it up. Now, whenever the time comes to decide what we're going to listen to, Ola grins at me and suggests the leg of the duck. And so, the name Ulysses has undergone a metamorphosis and become the leg of the duck, at least in my house and the house of one other Irish family of Nigerian and Somali origin. Is it perhaps over-familiar of me to think that Jim Joyce might have been amused?
The Mammoth Street entrance of Nighttown, before which stretches an uncobbled tram siding set with skeleton tracks, red and green will-o'-the-wisps and danger signals. Rows of flimsy houses with gaping doors, rare lamps with faint rainbow fans. Round Rabbi Yotti's halted ice gondola, stunted men and women squabble. They grab wafers between which are wedged lumps of coal and copper snow. Sucking, they scatter slowly. Sissy Caffrey's voice, still young, sings shrill from a lane.
I gave it to Molly because she was jolly, the leg of the duck, the leg of the duck.
She sings.
I gave it to Nelly to stick in her belly, the leg of the duck, the leg of the duck.
I have been watching all month, watching the light grow, trying to be ready for the solstice, because each year Midsummer's Day always comes too soon, unannounced and unwanted, but here again, tripping me, tipping me back into the slow tilt towards autumn. How can that be? We have only just begun our summer. I am never ready for this day. Never emotionally prepared for the solstice. So, in recent years, I've made a real effort not to let the day sneak up on me. I try to make myself ready for its coming and send myself out into the garden each night of June like a watchman looking into the fading light as the summer dusk comes slowly down each evening, later and later. So by the time we're here at midsummer, I am somehow synchronized to its arrival and in some way aligned to the workings of our small part of this vast cosmos. Out here on the west coast of Clare, the midsummer days take so long to fade over the wide Atlantic Ocean that they hardly ever darken. Short hours of dusky half-light pass before another dawn comes, and the sun rises up bright and blaring to pour its metallic glitter across the surface of the waves. Here in the west, light comes at you from all directions. Sky, sea, even the land glints with brilliance. And if the solstice horizons are clear, you can see in the south the Kerry Mountains. In the west, the Aran Islands, where the pale cliffs of Dún Éingus shimmer majestically up out of the waves. To the north, you can see Connemara and count its 12 bends. The land and the day both feel spread out before you, unending. I like to keep the solstice free, to take the day off, to not have anything to do but watch its long hours pass. More than at any other time, I want to be here on the earth, witnessing its beauty. The day is for me a kind of retaking of a vow, a remaking of a promise I have made to myself that I will not squander my life here on earth. I shall not die without ever having really seen this place and its wonders. The solstice reminds me not to take our world's beauty for granted. It reminds me to get up more often to witness the sunrise. to always salute the moon when I see her, to live by the earth's rhythms and let the seasons and light itself enchant me, govern me. Of course, I forget my vow over and again. All through my ordinary days, I forget and remember and forget. But the solstice reawakens my vow. It pushes me to get up for the dawn, to pitch a tent in the wild, to linger with the moon and stars as they pass overhead. This midsummer, I will go again to Palnabrone Dolmen deep in the Burren. I will go not because of any alignment of its stones, but because it is the oldest marker of human ritual in this place. Stones aligned for the purpose of reverence. I will go to Palnabrone because I went there too in deep midwinter, when the long dark ruled and night came down at 4 in the afternoon. Such a time of vulnerability that was, of uncertainty, as the old year ended and the new one had not yet come in. At midsummer, the sun will not set behind Palnabrone until 10 minutes past 10. I plan to be there through the late summer dusk as the sun sinks down in the west. I will watch for the first star, will look for the rise of the crescent moon. I'll listen as the birds settle, listen until the last bird sings her final note of evening. And then, as the long solstice day ends, I will put out my hand and touch the ancient dolmen stones, a gesture of gratitude, a thank you for the shelter and nourishment and protection the earth has given me since midwinter. My feet planted on the Burren limestone, with the light dissolving all around me, I shall do as humans have done since the dawn of time, and surrender to the mysterious forces of life.
Sing a song of old, love the one you hold.
Poet, painter, playwright, politician, economist, editor, mystic. Labelled that myriad-minded man, George William Russell was born in Lurgan in 1867 and died in Bournemouth in 1935. He spent almost his entire life in Dublin, where he was a central figure in the cultural and public life of the city and country for over 4 decades. He contributed more than any other individual to diverse aspects of Irish life during that period. The breadth of his expertise was all the more remarkable since he shunned formal education, declaring, "I learned nothing at school, being quite clever enough to evade knowledge by seeming to possess it." Russell met W.B. Yeats when both attended the Metropolitan School of Art. They became lifelong friends and occasional rivals. With a shared interest in the esoteric, Yeats and Russell joined the Theosophical Society of Madame Blavatsky, whose aim was to unite the various religions of the world into a single spiritual movement. They were deeply influenced by the Hindu mystic Mohini Chatterjee, who visited Ireland to establish its Dublin Lodge. Another visitor was its first president, Colonel Olcott, one of whose lectures was entitled "The Irish Fairies Scientifically Considered." As a youth, Russell experienced frequent trances, waking dreams of heightened consciousness with visions of cosmic happenings. He believed that a strange self, indeed a multiplicity of beings, was trying to enter his body. He was employed as an accountant at Pym's Drapery Store in South Great Georgia Street, a tiresome occupation from which his daily reveries provided alleviation. In 1897, recommended by Yeats, he took up employment with Horace Plunkett's Irish Agricultural Organisation Society, where his job was to establish farming cooperatives and credit banks around the country.
He also edited the Society's journal, The Irish Homestead. He travelled through every county in Ireland, talking to farmers about the advantages of cooperatives, discoursing on his favourite topics of pigs, poetry, poultry and metaphysics. One farmer requested a loan to buy a suit. When Russell pointed out this was not the best attire for farm work, nor the most agriculturally productive, he explained that it would enable him to marry a girl who owned 2 acres, a pig and £25. Russell acquired various monikers, including the Hairy Fairy, because of his bushy beard and voluminous head of hair. As nom de plume, he himself chose Aeon, the Greek word for epoch or age, a term used by the ancient Gnostics to refer to the eternal order of spirit. Russell's printer had difficulty reading his writing and curtailed it to AE. Russell gladly adopted it as his appellation and from then on signed everything AE. Russell seems to have been universally loved. Patrick Kavanagh called him a great and holy man. Frank O'Connor related, Russell would cheerfully get you a new doctor, a new wife, a new flat or a new job, and if you were ill, he'd come along and cook for you and nurse you. One evening when he came to my flat and found I'd been ill for the preceding week, the tears came into his eyes and he said, you should have sent for me. I could have cooked for you. I'm quite a good cook. I can cook chops, you know. In August 1902, A.E. arrived home to find a young James Joyce sitting on his doorstep in Rathgar. Having listened to his poems, A.E. pronounced, young man, there is not enough chaos in you to be a poet. Joyce riposted that while it was intellectually interesting, theosophy was a refuge for renegade Protestants. 20 years later, A.E. was immortalized in the Scylla and Charybdis episode of Joyce's Ulysses, which takes place in the National Library. The discussion centers on the origin and meaning of art. All these questions are purely academic, Russell oracled out of his shadow. The supreme question about a work of art is out of how deep a life does it spring. The deepest poetry of Shelley, the words of Hamlet bring our mind into contact with the eternal wisdom, Plato's world of ideas. All the rest is the speculation of schoolboys for schoolboys. In the episode, Stephen Dedalus is asked about the pound borrowed from Russell when he was hungry. He theorizes on the physical alteration of his body in the intervening period in the hope that he can be absolved from the debt. Wait 5 months. Molecules all change. I am other I now. Other I got pound. But as a convinced Aristotelian, Stephen recalls that what defines him are not the material molecules of his body, but the spiritual form of his soul. He must pay up. Joyce gives us perhaps the most brilliant joke in literature, a complete sentence made up of the 5 vowels. Stephen submits, A-E, I owe you.
It's a late Saturday night, and this evening it's just me in the house. I decide to give my father a call, because I know we don't talk enough, and my mother is away somewhere this weekend, so he's all alone at home. I just want to hear his voice, let him know that he's not alone. He picks up my call after 2 rings, and a video of him pops up on my screen. He's wearing a hat and a fleece-lined vest, sitting at the tiny fireplace in the only room that can sustain any kind of warmth. 100-year-old wooden house by the sea is not an easy place to be, when the north wind arrives carrying harsh rains, tearing at the seams of the structure. Maybe it's the light, but he looks much older than I remember. There's a long silence at first, and I wonder if there's a connection issue, but I can still hear him breathing. Do you miss home? He asks, eventually. I don't know, Dad. I guess so. If he'd asked me a year ago, the answer would have been more clear-cut. I do miss home, but not in any way I understand. Sometimes I get so homesick, I have to lie down on the floor. But even then, I don't necessarily want to go back. Never mind. Sorry about that, he says. How have you been? I'm all right. I'm doing my best. I know you are. Then he says, listen to this. He goes on to recite a poem he's come up with on his way home from work. I listen with my eyes closed, concentrating on his voice and how it breaks the silence in a gentle but sure way. My father is a poet, although he would not agree with that description. Maybe he'd smile and take it as a joke. He's a poet who has never written a single word of it down. All his poems are spoken, fluid, vivid, fueled by the moments in which they are created. He does not feel the pressure to make any of it perfect or make any of it last. Sometimes I tell him to slow down so I can put it down on paper. But he smiles and tells me that there's no point, that his poems have to rise in the air and dissipate. They live and die in settings and scenes, always between himself and the people who happen to be there with him. I no longer try to convince him otherwise. We talk about other things. He tells me about my siblings, what they're doing. I've heard all this from my mother, but I don't say so. I like to hear him talk about all the small, mundane things of life. We're on the call for a good 2 hours. He is a man made up of very old scar tissue. Not physical. Not the kind you can see or the kind a passerby would give a second look. All his scars are on the inside. The Soviet army forced him out of education, took the words from his mouth and the dreams from his heart, and left him with no way to explain any of it. Scar tissue has no nerve endings. It does not feel or touch. All he has left is phantom pain. Pain in limbs that are no longer there. Nobody really tells you how much worse that is than living pain. I am my father's daughter through and through. I have not only his face, but also his stubborn mind. Even though I've seen all the ways in which it has hurt him to have an exact mirror of himself, I also know that he's learned to extend a bit more compassion toward himself. I know he has disapproved of some of my choices, but I know that he is still proud of me. Did your mother make you call me? He asks now. No, Dad. I'm just calling you because I want to. Okay, then. You look good. You look like you're happy. And I know what he's really saying. I don't come up with any comments or explanations. Thanks, Dad. I love you too.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I could offer a warm embrace to make you feel my love.
The evening before my daughter Fia's 9th birthday, I recorded a short video of her soloing a football across the living room floor. I suppose it was my feeble attempt as a parent to resist the passing of time, and as someone who's chronically forgetful, a way to make sure I could pin down and remember this everyday moment of fun in her life. Fia was looking forward to her birthday because they were due to start Gaelic football in school and because her classmates were going to sing happy birthday to her. She still hadn't forgiven last year's teacher for forgetting to do this. Her presents included a green and yellow football she insisted on bringing to school that day. She was to give her teacher a note telling her that I'd need to collect her a little early as she had an appointment with her ear, nose and throat doctor to check on her grommets. I mentioned in the note that it was her birthday as a reminder to have the class sing happy birthday. When I cycled to school later to collect her, it was lashing rain and I could tell something was wrong. We didn't play Gaelic football, she told me, and I lost my ball. She'd been playing ball tag with some kids and had accidentally kicked it over the wall at the back of the school. It was impossible to get it back, she said, and some of the kids had laughed. By the time we reached the ENT doctor, we were drenched, and she was miserable. To cheer her up, I asked her if it was nice having Happy Birthday sung to her by her class. She burst into tears, suddenly realizing that her teacher had forgotten. She declared it the worst birthday ever. I sat beside her.